Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, March 22nd, for the last part of the show, the part we're going to hear now, Alan and Joe spoke with immunology and allergy specialist Dr. Jim Fagan.
Dr. Fagan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine. Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. So one of the big stories, of course, is the AstraZeneca vaccine, which we now learn protects fully against COVID-19's worst outcomes, according to a new study. This as AstraZeneca is looking to we've already made it available an announcement to make it available from the U.S. to Mexico and Canada. And now a large clinical trial in the U.S. Says that it has provided strong protections against COVID-19. This after Europe was still shaken and the giving of the vaccine was suspended because of concerns about possible rare side effects. So I asked two questions to begin. One is this fairly common when we are introducing vaccines, number one, and number two, how concerned should we be then about AstraZeneca?
I think the evidence shows that AstraZeneca is a very effective vaccine and certainly is on par with both Pfizer and Moderna in terms of preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death, which is really what we want from these vaccines. You know, the question of possible side effects always comes up with any new pharmaceutical product. And I think it's very important to be able to discern what is a coincidental side effect that may occur in someone who has received a vaccine and has absolutely nothing to do with the vaccine, and to be able to discern that from a true vaccine-related reaction. When the data from AstraZeneca was analyzed, it would appear that the vaccine was not causing those rare thrombotic events with blood clots in those individuals. You know, I tell you, Joe, I think back to the Pfizer vaccine. You know, if you recall, the Pfizer vaccine, when the Pfizer vaccine first came out, it was first used in England. And on day one of administering the Pfizer vaccine, there were a report of three individuals who had anaphylactic reactions to the Pfizer vaccine. And that threw everybody up in the air and said, oh, my God, what's going on here? And when it turned out that when you looked at the clinical trials, there was not a single person. There were almost, I think Pfizer had 40, 50,000 individuals in their phase 3 clinical trial. Not a single one of them had an anaphylactic reaction to the vaccine. And you know, I use that as an example of how these things can be, you know, misleading. It is, you know, the Pfizer vaccine has a excipient in it called polyethylene glycol, which can be allergic to certain people. The incidence of that is less than one in a million. And so, again, I think we have to be careful in terms of not pushing the panic button when there are reports of medical issues that develop in someone who's been vaccinated. Right now, as far as we know, the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccines are safe. They're very effective. You know, there are side effects to these vaccines, the injection site pain and swelling and redness. And then, you know, for a day or two, you can be fatigued and have headache and muscle pain. And those things are to be expected and are normal. And I always remind people that that's a good sign because it means the vaccine is working. So I think I'm glad that the European Medicine Agency made a strong statement about AstraZeneca, and it is being, as far as I understand, used again in most European nations. So I think it's a good, you know, we have not approved it yet, as you know, in the United States, and I have every reason to believe that it will receive, approval, emergency use approval in the United States as well. So I think it's a good vaccine, a safe vaccine, and certainly every evidence that it's a very effective vaccine.
Now, Jim, my question to you is, for those of us who have gotten the vaccine because of age and whatever else, and I think you're one of them.
Yep.
There is now a question as to what happens next. Should we continue to wear a mask? I believe we should, but I'm not that kind of doctor. So what's the answer?
The answer is absolutely unequivocally yes. You should continue to wear a mask. You know, the only way we're going to get back to a normal life is to reach that herd immunity level and to create enough immunity to this vaccine in the overall population so that the virus really has no place to go. And that's when it's going to die out. And that's where wearing a mask is so important. The vaccine, you know, it's interesting because the vaccine, and I think we've talked about this before, the vaccine, you know, it's designed to prevent serious disease, hospitalization, and death. Will it prevent a possible asymptomatic or low-grade infection? We don't really have an absolute answer to that question, and a lot of people will say, no, it doesn't. And we certainly, probably most of us know people who were sick with COVID-19 and then got reinfected, or those who, you know, had the vaccination now and then, may have had a low-grade COVID-19 infection after that. I think that the wearing of the mask is really, really important in order to achieve that overall herd immunity. We want to stop the transmission of this virus, and also especially because of the possibility of mutations and the variant strains. And it makes it even more important that we all wear a mask, because that the mutation doesn't occur unless the virus infects a new person, gets into a new body, and that's when the mutations begin to arise. And if we can prevent that transmission, then we will certainly put a lid on the mutations of this virus and the variant strains.
And we don't know how long this thing is going to last, do we? In other words, we get the shot. But we don't have the slightest idea about whether it's 5 months, 6 months, a year, or forever. When will we find that out?
Time will tell. And it's a new vaccine, and the overwhelming likelihood is that the immunity to the vaccine will last for several, probably a few years. And it's possible even lifetime. There is good evidence now that immunity, the immune response to the vaccine, is much better than the immune response to the natural infection, which is why we tell people who were infected with COVID-19 that they still need to get vaccinated.
Hmm.
Dr. Fagan, you mentioned just a moment ago as we began our conversation together about variants and the concerns over those variants. What do we know right now? We know that over the weekend we heard that there was one of the Brazilian variants that was present in a patient in Brooklyn. How concerning is that overall, and what should we make of such stories as we try to get this virus under some control?
The problem with the variants is real. There's no question about that, and it is of a major concern. I mean, we're in a battle right now between, you know, despite our evolutionary advantage, we're in a major battle between the genetic willpower of the SARS-CoV-2 virus to mutate in order to evade, you know, the human immune response. There's no question that majority of the variants that are currently present in the United States are very responsive to the vaccines that we have, so thank God for that. But, the Brazilian, that P1 variant, right, in Brazil is a nasty variant because it has been shown to be less responsive to vaccination. It tends to be more present with more morbidity and mortality, and it's a real concern. And I certainly hope that we don't see that P1 variant become a dominant variant in our country, because it will be a problem.
Dr. Jim Fagan on the Roundtable panel last Monday, March 22nd. For Tuesday's Roundtable panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
I'm going to start with the story out of Boulder this morning. I don't know, there isn't a tremendous amount to say other than to reflect on how horrific it is. Another shooting in this country so close to the one in Atlanta. But 10 people killed, including a police officer. A suspect is in custody. King Soopers grocery store on Monday, including where 10 people were killed, including a Boulder police officer, after a shooter opened fire on customers and responding officers. Law enforcement officials said the suspect, who carried out the attack with a rifle, was in custody, but they offered scarce details about the deadly shooting, including any information about a possible motive. The Boulder police commander said in a brief news conference that the suspect was being treated for an injury. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Dougherty said that officials were still working to notify family members of the victims. 51-year-old Boulder officer Eric Talley was among the first to respond and among those killed by the shooter.
Seven children.
Yes. And the police chief vowed that police will work night and day to complete the investigation, which she said will take no less than 5 days. And just right outside to the northwest of the city of Denver, the rampage was the latest in a long history of mass shootings in the Denver area and comes as the nation is still grappling with a devastating attack in Atlanta that left 8 people dead, including 6 Asian women, less than a week earlier.
Well, I guess we all know that it comes down to guns and how many guns there are in this gun-crazy country of ours. When you poll people, they tell you that there are too many guns, and they want sensible gun control. And yet, the gun makers, the people who are selling the guns, and we certainly have them around here, and others are adamant in protecting, quote, the right of people to have guns. Well, you see what's happening. Somebody made a point in the paper this morning that I thought was so good, which was, you know, if it didn't stop after that Connecticut shooting of those beautiful little children, it wasn't going to stop. I mean, what kind of people don't understand how important, you know, some kind of a hold on this is? It's just crazy. The country is gun crazy, period. End of discussion for me.
Yeah, everything Alan said, plus I would add the lack of real treatment options for people with mental illness. I think that's part of it. I hope that Joe Biden will make it a high priority to push through gun control legislation in the same way that he has done relief, the giant relief bill over the protests, kicking and screaming of Republicans who apparently are content to allow America to have, as we have in the past week, one mass shooting per day. It's to the point where you cannot go to school, you cannot go to buy food, you cannot live your life without the threat of being shot unexpectedly by some guy who has no motive or no discernible motive, who you don't even know. That's terrorism.
It is, absolutely, and it's just very scary because by the random nature of it. Mike Spain, I know you're familiar with that region, and
it's sad because there have been, you know, Columbine, of course, being the biggest, but then the shooting in the movie theater, in
Aurora
nearby. Yeah, right, Aurora, and it's just become commonplace in our society. What is striking to me, you know, to Alan's point, is that, Americans want gun controls. They want background checks. They don't want easy availability to firearms. They want they're ready to accept control, but Congress just won't do it. They won't. They stand in the way. So this may be another reason for Biden to modify and the Democrats to modify the filibuster to push some of these things through that have been just getting, cut off by the Republicans in Congress, who are influenced by big money from, you know, the gun industry and elsewhere. And it's just maybe this is the time. I mean, I guess this will bring the issue to the forefront, this and last week's shootings in Atlanta. Yeah.
JP.
I agree with everything that Mike and Rosemary and Alan said, and I do think it's unfortunate that it takes these continued shootings for us to start talking about this issue again. We have Democratic control of the House of Representatives, we have Democratic control of the United States Senate, and we have President Biden in the White House, and no one is talking that there's even really a possibility of passing any gun control reforms. Last time Democrats controlled all branches of government back from 2008 to 2010 with Obama as president, they also didn't do anything then. And of course, it's Republicans that are blocking it. But Democrats also, when they're in control, for whatever reason, they're not willing to pass gun control. The last time that we passed any meaningful gun control was 30 years ago in 1994. And I hope that we New Yorkers will pressure Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, our own U.S. Senator, to take up gun control. Think about those seven kids this morning that are waking up without a dad.
You know, Alan, you talked about this, and yeah, it's just that random nature of this that you can't, you know, you can't, and Rosemary touched on that too, you can't go to school, you can't go to the grocery store, you can't go to church. All of these places that are either mundane or very meaningful and are a part of our lives have become targets, and you never know. And it is, and you wonder how you keep people. I mean, obviously there's the gun element, that's the main element, but how you keep people safe, even as the guns are out in the streets of someone walking in broad daylight with a firearm and killing so many people in such a short period of time.
You know, Joe, as long as people will have guns, and the number is in the millions, you're going to get somebody who is, frankly, mentally ill and will do something like what we have seen. You know, my question is, at what point do the American people do what they can do? In other words, if you take a poll, the American people are widely and wildly for gun control, and yet we have I'll eschew the adjective which I'm thinking right now, the Supreme Court, which made all of this happen and which has allowed this to happen. You can say, well, no, the founders made it happen. No, they didn't. Go read the Constitution again. But the interpretation was so scurrilous that until the American people say this has got to stop, and I mean really say this has got to stop, you know, we've had movements, we've had Brady, we've had, you name the number of people, but until people make a demand that will be heard in Congress and scare the something out of them, it won't change. So now it's the question to me of the political will of the American people. If they want it, they can get it, but they got to really want it and they got to really say something.
We are being told by police that it's an AR-15 style rifle that was used, which is a lightweight semi-automatic rifle. AR stands for Armalite 15 design. I know many say that it is either an assault rifle or an automatic rifle, but it is not. It is a semi-automatic rifle. And legal.
But it is an assault rifle.
It is an assault rifle.
It gets used in assaults quite often.
Absolutely. And it is also legal in many places, and legal to carry. We do not know what the situation is in this particular case, but we do know that despite bans, even in the state of Colorado, that high-capacity magazines for those AR-15, in other words, like a 60-round drum, are still readily sold within that state. So there is an issue with the guns, and there's also an issue with the ammunition. Yes.
Right. JP mentioned the last reform was back in 1994, which included the Congress included an assault rifle ban, but that expired that made these guns available again, and Congress didn't have, you know, it was during, I think, 2002 or during the Bush administration when it came up for renewal. I mean, why would they put an expiration date on something so important? Because they knew they could get it back in if they just did nothing, and they're good at that. So, you know, I mean, there's no excuse for someone having a AR-15. I mean, it's like an AK-47. It's an assault rifle. It's meant to efficiently shoot people. It's not a hunting rifle. It just, to me, I cannot understand it.
So to make your head hurt a little bit more, a Colorado judge blocked Boulder, Colorado, from enforcing its two-year-old assault rifle ban on March 12th. So that's, what, a week and a few days ago. Ruling it violated a 2003 state law prohibiting municipalities from enacting their own firearms regulations. Boulder City spokeswoman Shannon Alaba said that city attorneys would meet to decide on whether to appeal the ruling by the Boulder County District Court Judge Andrew Hartman. That according to the Denver Post. But in the meantime, the Boulder Police Department wouldn't enforce the ban on AR-15 style rifles and large capacity magazines. And this was reported, of course, last night after the shooting at the King Super. Not to say that these things won't happen if strict laws are enforced. However, you do have to wonder, as these things happen, if it will not help in passing the laws, although we have not seen that in the past.
And what's wrong with Colorado? I mean, it does seem to, you know, I've spent time there. It's a wonderful state, you know, in so many ways. And yet there's something in the air there that leads to so much of this.
Well, Colorado's the Wild West.
Yeah.
And a lot of it still is. You got that new Congress member, Boebert, you know, from Western Colorado, who's, you know, wants to carry a Glock into the floor of the House of Representatives. I mean, there's a lot of mixture of cultures out there. And one of the cultures is, you know, the old Wild West.
You know, Rosemary, I'm interested in your thoughts, but this is Boulder, this ban that they decided not to renew. They enacted it right after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida because an AR-15 was used, as it is in many mass shootings across this country. And yet, I guess I'm curious as to why you put a two-year time limit on it.
Because they don't want a limit at all. I mean, the gun control people have, the pro-gun people have been immensely successful in keeping the Second Amendment, not alive, but so active, way beyond what I believe that the founders intended. And there's no hope for a change right now. I mean, don't kid yourself. You've got a federal judiciary stuffed with Trump advocates who are Second Amendment champions, and they do not believe in gun control, just like that judge out in Colorado. And even if strong legislation is enacted, it's going to go and be challenged in courts that are very sympathetic to no controls. It's become the cult of the Second Amendment. It's sort of like evangelicals who believe in literal translation of the Bible. You can no longer think about evolution as real because it wasn't in the Bible. That's how we are with that Second Amendment. It was never intended for this purpose. And what it would take to battle it, I think, are first a legislature, the Congress, willing to expend political capital, because it will take that, and very cleverly written legislation that can get around the jurisprudence barriers that will be thrown in the way. I don't have much hope of this. I find it interesting that the one protection is to go along with the gun people and get more guns. And I find that happening in my own family, that to protect themselves, they think they need guns. So it kind of spreads the culture rather than does away with it. I don't see an end to this. It's part of my gloom and doom thing. Do you? Do any of you?
You know, it's a representative government. We elect legislators. The polls are all showing people wildly for gun control in this country. And yet those representatives who are representing us in the Congress aren't doing what we want them to. Nope, they're more interested in money. They're more interested in a minority of a minority just saying, we will punish you and we'll make sure you get punished. And it's disgusting because political courage is in such short order.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, March 23rd. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Wednesday's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Rosemary Armeo again, along with lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson, and dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
The president said tighter gun laws should not be a partisan issue, but Republicans in Congress showed little interest in Democratic proposals. Here's what happened. Faced with the second mass shooting in a week, President Biden and Democrats on Capitol Hill called on Tuesday for fast action to enact stricter gun laws, a plea that was immediately met with a blockade of opposition by Republicans. In brief, somber remarks from the White House, Mr. Biden called on the Senate to pass a ban on assault weapons and to close background check loopholes, saying that doing so would be common sense steps that will save lives in the future. His demand for action was the latest in what has become a doleful ritual in Washington, making a renewed call for gun safety legislation after a deadly shooting, this one at a Colorado grocery store where 10 people, including a police officer, were killed on Monday. This is not and should not be a partisan issue. It is an American issue, Mr. Biden says. We have to act. But while polling regularly shows broad support for tighter gun laws and specific policies like a ban on assault weapons, Republicans in Congress remained all but immovable on the issue, repeating longstanding arguments on Tuesday that gun violence should be addressed through steps like more policing rather than limiting gun rights. Alan, let's start with you.
Well, you know how I feel. I talked about this yesterday. We had quite a little discussion here. I said this is the time to act. And Joe Biden is doing exactly what he should be doing. I mean, what can you do? Stand by and do nothing? This is a terror for so many people. It's going to move forward. I think that the Democrats, if they want to, if they can get a certain West Virginia's senator with them, if they can do what needs to be done, they will win the day. This is where democracy really is tested, because we know that massive numbers of Americans are for this, including 88% of Republicans, when polled, want these background checks and these other things that we can do. So I have no doubt that this is well worth spending time on, and we ought to do it.
I disagree completely, because even this discussion right now is part of the ritual that we go through every time there is a mass killing, and there are more of them and more of them all the time, 29 in the past 4 years, where four or more people have been killed. That is just outrageous. It's always been outrageous. We kill first graders, and we say to polls, oh, yeah, we really, really do want gun control. And then we put into place people like Ted Cruz and Mitch McConnell, and that keeps happening, and nothing will change in our Senate until we start voting differently. And that isn't going to be in the short term, despite having Biden and Schumer, who are both ardent and proven proponents of gun control, of reasonable gun control. So today I am hating on Ronald Reagan. It's interesting, he's a saint now of the Republican Party, but it was Reagan and the NRA, of which he is a member, who first began this switch from the Second Amendment being seen as applying to a militia to applying to individual right to unfettered gun ownership. And that only is from the 70s. It's not from the beginning of our republic. It's from the 1970s that we began getting this ridiculous idea that guns should be easy to get and that even mentally ill and criminal people should not be stopped from getting guns. It all goes back to just those, really a few decades ago, our lifetimes, at least those of us on the program. For me, I'm going to listen to this. I'm glad they did something. You're right, they had to do something, but I do think it's all futile. The discussion now has to move into the courts, where you've got to switch the meaning of the Second Amendment back to its original meaning. Let's really have originalists, and to the state legislatures, where we can get action. If it didn't happen after Connecticut, it never will.
Well, first of all, I think you're right about that. That was one of the great shames of this country. Mm-hmm. But I do think we are at a point now where we're moving forward. Look, so things start in one way, and as people push and push and push, you get relief. You got a Joe Biden elected. That didn't look like it could happen. It happened. And now I think we're moving forward on this gun control thing. Look, Rosemary, I don't think you can turn your back on it. I think you have to do whatever you can. I predicted yesterday that Biden would. I don't want to get into he said, she said, but you said yesterday that you thought it was a big mistake because there were other things to do. I think you take your opportunities, your political opportunities, when they are presented. And boy, if there ever was a time it's presented, it's right now.
Well, again, I thought you might bring that up. I still think I'm right. He has proposed very modest action, and I do not think you'll find him stumping and supporting it and dropping all his other things. I think this is a pro forma required action, and it's for show. It's like saying prayers and condolences.
For his part yesterday, Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican of Texas, criticized the Democrats for, quote, ridiculous theater, and said that gun control does not lessen crime, it makes it worse. Bob Griffin.
First, you know, Rosemary, it's really interesting that you raised Ronald Reagan. One of the reasons that the California's gun laws are so tight is when Reagan was governor, he put them in place because the Black Panther Party, who were at the time exercising their constitutional rights, and it frankly scared the white GOP in California enough to change the laws. So I there's some interesting subtext to the whole Ronald Reagan comment. And I would note, Rosemary, that he may be a hero in some areas of the GOP. He couldn't get elected today. Ronald Reagan would not be elected by the GOP the way it is right now. You know, the issue of getting to 50, I keep looking at it, and I don't see a pathway to 50, even for something that I think is incredibly reasonable. As I've said before on the show, Joe, I'm a gun owner. I'm a responsible gun owner. I love to shoot. At times, I chafe under what I think are overly restrictive processes. At the same time, though, I'm a firm believer that that it is it is something that we should be looking at my mental health. We should be looking at my background. That this is something that needs to be taken a lot more seriously. Going back to the comment about Cruz, and I thought that was really interesting about the ridiculous theater, because, you know, we want to talk ridiculous theater. I have other examples. But there are a couple issues I want to toss on the table. One is, you know, what is the role of our political leaders right now? Is it good? Should you get elected or reelected by just opposing a policy and not putting in anything on the table? And this is the problem that I have right now with Congress, particularly the Senate. You know, you look at Cruz and Tarpaville and some others, and understand before you say, oh, Bob, you know, you're getting into partisan politics, in different issues, it happens on the left, too. But just this idea of constantly saying no without providing any thought or any potential policy is, you know, I think it's that they're not fulfilling their fiduciary responsibilities. I also put on the table, because I'd love to hear some thoughts on this, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the amount of money in politics tied to this issue. I think there is a clear correlation with the position, particularly in Congress, and the amount of money that the gun lobby, particularly NRA, has put into the coffers and continues to put into the coffers.
Terry Gibson.
Well, just in trying to think what I can contribute to this conversation, I have to reflect back on my time in the state Senate, where I did have personal experience with this issue, because that was right at the time of Sandy Hook. So I was in the Senate at that time. And what I learned from that, and having voted for the New York Safe Act, which continues to be one of the strongest anti-gun pieces of legislation in the country, I learned that what the polls say do not necessarily reflect voter behavior. And I think we see that time and time again, and it kind of goes to Rosemary's point. I remember after voting for that SAFE Act, I remember conducting polling. I remember my colleagues conducting polling, and we all in the upstate and Hudson Valley area came up with the same results, that this, even though we had really put our seats on the line and taken a very aggressive step, this desire to use this as a voting issue was not high. It still was well below things like employment, housing, environmental protection. It was way, way down the list. And I do remember still very clearly, this was one of the few times that I went to an actual meeting with Governor Andrew Cuomo and sat right beside him in a meeting. And I remember him looking at me and saying, "Gibson, that was a really gutsy thing you did voting for the SAFE Act." Because he knew that I had probably ended my political career by doing that. And it turned out he was right, along with many of my colleagues. So the reason that we continue to have this stalemate in not only individual states, but in countries, is that because of the gerrymandered nature of our politics and because of the uniqueness of the federal Senate, you still have a situation where a minority of people who have very far-right extreme ideas about gun control continue to have an enormous amount of electoral power. And that is reflected in many elected officials' unwillingness to take up this legislation.
But let me ask you a question. When you were a state senator, I know you've spoken eloquently here, Terry, about, taking political risk. But isn't political risk worth it if you are doing what, the simple test to me is doing what's right? Question mark.
Well, I think that's an individual question for individual people. It was worth it for me. I took the risk. It was worth it for me and my colleagues. And you've seen it. You've seen it. You've seen congressional people at the federal level and senators at the federal level take those risks too and not be reelected for that same reason. So, yeah, it's worth the risk. But at the same time, you have to maintain an elective body. Your party has to maintain a majority so that you can move these things forward. And at the federal level, we continue to fail to do that. Now, I do really strongly believe that this can only be solved at the federal level. Individual states doing what they can is good, but it's just a Band-Aid because you can't stop these guns from crossing state lines ultimately. And while it's helpful, we really have to go back and create an assault weapons ban like we did back in 1994. We have to remember that back then we didn't have people like Ted Cruz and all of his entire sort of far right coalition. They didn't have the kind of power they have now in electoral politics. They existed, but they weren't as powerful. But they're extremely powerful now. And until the Democrats can find a way to get more people in the Senate at the federal level, it's just going to be really difficult to do.
I just want to mention there was an interesting article in the Washington Post. One of the things that comes up inevitably as we discuss this issue, it certainly did yesterday, is what happens in other countries. And I thought the Washington Post piece today was interesting in showing what other countries have done and the various successes that they have had in dealing with this problem. They had a horrible shooting in August of 87 with a AK-47. They had a few others, another one in 1997. It led to a campaign called Snowdrop, and it was a firearms act which ended up restricting ownership of almost all handguns. Tens of thousands of guns were collected from owners who were given market value for the weapons. The police spent years cracking down on illegal gun ownership. Gun violence peaked in 2005 and has declined in the years since. Meanwhile, in Australia, where there have been shootings as well, they also had a buyback plan. 650 firearms. Some studies have indicated the program may have been a success and that Australia became a less violent place in the years since that buyback. We go to New Zealand, and they, of course, have had their share most recently in 2009, passed major laws in 2020, which required setting up a new firearms registry that gun license holders were required to update as they buy or sell firearms. And then, of course, there are neighbors to the north in Canada, a mass shooting in April of 2020. Justin Trudeau announced a ban on more than 1,500 makes and models of military-style assault rifles, including the AR-15. Some of those laws have been brought into place. Others have not, although the buyback plan is the one that seems to be angering many. But meanwhile, the numbers of gun violence incidents because of gun violence have gone down significantly in Canada. So for whatever that's worth, Bob, what do you think?
A couple things, Joe. I think it shows part of the issue of how this is communicated. What's been done in other countries, it varies from, you know, really, really strict regulation and buyback to more focused. In this country, I support this idea of focused gun control, particularly on military style weapons. Large capacity bullets, you know, bullet holders, the type of ammunition. I see no reason for anybody to be able to go in and buy body armor. I also see no reason for somebody to be able to go in and buy, you know, shells that are designed to cut through armor. There is so much that we could do that would help with the situation, which isn't a total ban. And I think when we have these conversations, they become a very zero sum conversation. But there are some common sense rules, and you know, it was said earlier. And Terry, I appreciate everything you said. That you know, when you start to think about laws that have been in place and they worked well. I mean, so you start to think about the assault ban, the ban on assault weapons. You start to think about the limitations on the ability to buy automatic weapons. I mean, these are just common sense issues that have become so politicized that it's difficult to have this conversation without going down a lot of these little, big rat holes.
Lack of common sense is the whole problem, though.
You know,
we don't have it here. This is a unique problem, gun violence, to the United States. There are other industrialized countries of the world, you've mentioned them, where they also have mental illness, they also have criminals, they also have all the pressures of modern life, all the things that supposedly get blamed, they have bad police, all the things that get blamed except for guns for this outbreak, this huge, ridiculous number of mass killings we have. But in our country, we can't even get people to wear a mask to save their grandmother's life. How are we going to get them to sell their guns back?
Yeah. It's true. Joe, I just wanted to follow up on what Bob had just said. One of the things that I recall very vividly from my time in the Senate after voting for that SAFE Act gun legislation was that we were just overwhelmed with Second Amendment supporters coming in and wanting to talk to us. And we met with as many as we possibly could. And the one argument we heard over and over and over again from the majority of them was that they wanted to make sure that they could have access to whatever the police and the military had access to when it came to weapons. So to Bob's point, the true supporters of the Second Amendment have this deep-seated belief that if they're not able to purchase the same equipment that will be used against them, then they will not be able to defend themselves. And this is a very serious mindset of the far-right extreme gun supporters.
Terry Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 24th. We'll be back with our last segment of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. We'll be right back. Welcome to the final segment of this week's Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue spoke with President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Bruschetti, former EPA Regional Administrator, Visiting Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
New York has reached a deal, apparently, to legalize recreational marijuana. The move paves the way for a potential $4.2 billion industry. Millions of dollars in sales tax revenue reinvested in minority communities each year is the plan. Following several failed attempts, lawmakers in Albany struck an agreement with Governor Cuomo to legalize cannabis for adults 21 and older, a move that officials hope will help end years of racially disproportionate policing that saw Black and Hispanic people arrested on low-level marijuana charges far more frequently than white people. The deal would allow delivery of the drug and permit club-like lounges or consumption sites where marijuana but not alcohol could be consumed, according to details obtained by the New York Times. It would also allow a person to cultivate up to 6 marijuana plants at home, indoors or outdoors, for personal use. So,
but only after 18 months, Joe. I mean, in other words, there's a sort of rather large and, in my mind, inexplicable gap.
18 months from
when they pass the bill.
Yeah.
You're not going to be allowed to grow pot in your basement.
So, and then how soon does it go on sale?
Sooner? It's a couple years.
It is still a couple years away?
Yeah, they need to figure out how to regulate it. You know, the agencies don't move in a matter of months. It takes them years.
And I think we have to go to David because, you know, law enforcement is going to be rather important here. Somebody crashes a car. Let's just say they're high. And they crash your car. We know what happens with alcohol. David, what's going to happen to the prosecutors? What are you going to do when marijuana comes on?
Well, this is the major issue that we're all dealing with. And, you know, I think it's safe to say that it's what all of the various parties who are in that room engaging in discussions are negotiating over right now. Because, look, the position that we've taken, and I'm not the president of the DA's Association, but the position that we've taken is, look, we're concerned about underage consumption. We're concerned about roadway safety. And me personally, I'm concerned about what I would call, you know, the marijuana Marshall Plan. How are we going to make right, you know, all the wrongs of the past when it's come to enforcement? Well, thus far, what I hear about the marijuana legislation, they've got the underage consumption issue properly dealt with. So check that box. It's the roadway safety that I have tremendous concerns about, because in some of the earlier drafts, what they were planning to do was to make operating a motor vehicle under the influence of marijuana a violation, which is a step down from what it is with alcohol, which is a crime. Could be a misdemeanor, could be a felony. But what they were doing was attempting to create the equivalence of operating a motor vehicle under the influence of marijuana, a routine traffic ticket, which presents a tremendous amount of problems, because what you're doing is you're sending out the message that we don't take marijuana and operating motor vehicles as seriously. The language is terrible in some of the earlier drafts, which created a different standard for enforcing roadway safety when it comes to marijuana, because instead of having to prove that the driver was simply impaired, the language that was in some of the earlier drafts required that the police and prosecutors prove that the driver was substantially impaired. We don't know what the word substantially means, and it's not defined in the law. So it was creating two separate standards for marijuana and alcohol, when both are equally as dangerous when it comes to operating a motor vehicle. I'm hoping and I'm praying that this issue can be resolved, along with a few other issues that I think they need to take seriously before, you know, they make an agreement here.
Well, you can do, but David, you can prove the amount of alcohol, right, in somebody's blood, but you can't.
Yeah.
For everything I'm reading,
the problem here is that oftentimes when they're talking about marijuana and they talk about alcohol, there's a false equivalence. For example, alcohol, there's tests that you could administer that will tell you the amount of alcohol in the blood, and therefore establish whether a person is either impaired or not. And you still have to take that proof and do field sobriety examinations, like, you know, the fingers on the nose, the alphabet, reciting those things. So you still have a lot of field sobrieties that together with the test can help you establish building your case. The problem is, however, with marijuana, there's no evidence that the amount of THC that is in the blood has any kind of correlation with your impairment. THC will leave the blood more rapidly and will be absorbed in the fatty tissues in the brain. And therefore, we don't have a real test that can tell us to a legal certainty whether a person is impaired because of THC content in their blood. What the tests that are currently out there being used by other states can only tell you the recency of usage of marijuana, which is good because the saliva swab test, if that can determine that marijuana was recently used together with then all of the different field sobriety tests that are administered, that can help build your cases. But it's this idea that we're going to create an entirely different standard, and we're also going to create this equivalence between alcohol and marijuana that is preposterous. So many other states have attempted that. They have failed. We have the benefit of those lessons in front of us, and I think that we can move to a place where we can pass this and assure that the public roads are going to be safe. And I'll just say briefly, the other issue that I'm trying to, you know, wrap my arms around here is the marijuana Marshall Plan that has taxes and dollars going into communities that historically have been, you know, where those wars have been waged, a concept that I agree with. But we certainly have a lot of gentrification going on right now in the state of New York. And I don't know if you've been to the Tenbrook Triangle area here in Albany, but if you've ever been on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, it is not the same Flatbush Avenue that was there 20 years ago. And I could say the same thing about Harlem and other communities. And so if we're going to link neighborhoods with crime data as a way of ensuring that top tax dollars go back, you just got to make sure that it's the same people that are there that are going to receive the benefit.
Judith Enck, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think this bill is long overdue. There's been such a pattern of racism when it comes to enforcing drug laws. And, you know, the whole system is just kind of a disaster. Young people literally spending time in jail because they had something in their pocket, and, you know, people going to dealers to buy marijuana. I mean, the status quo is so unjust and bizarre and unworkable. That said, there are some legitimate issues, such as impaired driving. So now we have people talking on cell phones while they're stoned. So good luck with that, police officers. And I do think, even though it's 21 and older, some attention needs to be focused on underage use. Good luck, teachers. When, you know, we've all been to high school with that fellow student who showed up to class stoned every day. And what if it's larger numbers? And I know there's going to be a lot of letters on this, but I'm just being very practical in terms of high school teachers and the challenges they will face in law enforcement. That said, I think those are important details that need attention. But overall, this is a very important and positive change in the law that should have happened years ago.
So, Heather, how pumped is the business community for the idea of consumption sites?
Well, I'm not going to say that they're pumped about consumption sites. At least, you know, I don't have those members really at this point. But I mean, I think there's a significant concern to David's point that it's hard to measure impairment. And if you're on a work site and someone takes a lunch break and comes back and they're stoned, if you send them home or if you let them go, New York does not have a very employer-friendly system for things like unemployment, right? You can let someone go because they come to work stoned 5 days in a row, and you're probably going to lose an unemployment hearing because of your inability to prove definitively that the person was stoned. That being said, I mean, we have been working very hard on this legislation to try and ensure that there's good workplace protections and employer protections in there. And, you know, as a complete aside, and it's sort of random, but there's a company in Israel that has developed an app that is actually a response time app that can test your current impairment against a baseline, right? So you take a baseline test. It shows how fast you respond to certain stimulus or questions. And then you can an employer could have you take it again before you're allowed on a job site. And it wouldn't matter what the substance is. It would just show if your reaction time is impaired. It's down the road a bit, but there are tools out there that could help assist in ensuring that someone who's driving heavy equipment or whatever isn't either under the influence of opioids, for example, or marijuana or alcohol, or has, you know, suffered a concussion in between and has some kind of response impairment. So there are ways to do it. We just want to make sure that the tools are available because it does create a difficulty. A lot of employers test for marijuana, those who do random drug testing. Many have gone away from it because of the medical marijuana and the lingering, you know, presence of it in your system. It doesn't show present impairment. But it's going to be hard to determine whether someone should be operating equipment in the workplace. And my chicken says hello. She wanted to weigh in as well.
That's a lot to say on this issue of recreational weed. Alan, were you going to say something?
No. I think this is a can of worms in many ways. A lot of the things like testing in the workplace, that'll be challenged in courts. We know that. Whether or not we have the proper apparatus to do it. And people with response times, you say, okay, this guy had a better response time than the person over there. That becomes very problematic, at least for me, because I've always been slow. So if they say, if you're slower than somebody else, we think that there's probable cause for impairment. Now, I know that's going a long way.
No, the way it works is the baseline is against yourself, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, sure.
you would have your own baseline. And then if, you came in and you were significantly different than that, that would indicate that there's something going on.
Well, maybe somebody would say, well, I had a fight with my spouse last night or something like that, and that influenced it. But I want to say one more thing, and that is speaking for the people of Great Barrington, which I am not allowed to do, not elected.
Five.
we're going to miss all that tax
all right.
revenue.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Friday, March 26th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.